It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Shoe prints left at a crime scene can be key evidence for investigators trying to piece together what happened. And for shoe print evidence, having a large database of footwear impressions is essential. This allows investigators to zero in on what type of shoe they're looking at, sometimes down to the exact brand and style. Now, students at UW-Platteville are teaming up with the Wisconsin State Crime Lab to provide new reference prints of boots, sneakers, and other footwear for the state database. Jana Marie Truesdell is an assistant professor of criminal justice and forensic investigation at UW-Platteville, and Danielle Beyer is a sophomore and president of the Forensic Investigation Club on campus. Jana Marie and Danielle, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you.
Jana Marie, starting with you, take us to the scene of a crime, if you will. How do shoe prints come into play when investigators arrive at the scene and then start gathering evidence?
Well, it's part of impression evidence. So the footprints would maybe give us directionality where a perpetrator may have entered the scene, how they may have left the scene, what kind of shoes they were wearing, if they were boots, if they were tennis shoes, if they had any sort of unique impressions, then we might be able to exclude certain shoes. We don't say that specific things are perfect matches, but we can certainly exclude things that don't obviously match. So that sort of winnows down who we might be looking for, or at least the shoes that you're looking for.
The shoes that you're looking for. I mean, when you're looking at this shoe print, how do you determine things like the style or the size of a shoe?
Well, we would take either impressions. So if the shoe print was in some sort of substrate or medium like dirt or
mud,
snow or mud, anything like that. Yep. Then we can do what's called either dental stone or sometimes plaster of Paris, but it's essentially something, it's just a mix that hardens over the impression. And then you can take that away from the scene and send it to the lab. And then the lab can analyze, like you said, size and tread pattern. And they look at the outsole, things like that. Whereas if it is, say, in blood or something that, you know, wouldn't have any sort of texture to it, then we would photograph it in certain ways, use chemicals maybe, do lifts like we did for reference, but you could lift impressions once you had a potential shoe at, say, someone's home.
Danielle, can you talk about the work that you're doing and these impressions?
Yeah, so on our end, we hosted like a footwear impression clinic per se. And we invited students to come in, students and staff, to come and get their shoe impression. So what we did was we had them step on an ink pad and then step onto paper, and that showed us their shoe, the outsole they call it. And then we had them take their shoe off, and we took photos of every view of the shoe, including top, bottom, side, and as well as the tag information. So model number, size, make, model, all that kind of stuff. And then we uploaded it into the database, and then now it can get used.
And these shoes, they could be this year's model of a Nike, or they could be a loafer from 2 decades ago. Is that right?
Yeah, we invited people to bring their more unique shoes, per se, so not the daily sneakers, but we encouraged a lot of like boots, dress shoes, those kind of things that aren't as common that they might not have in the database already. And we did get quite a variety of shoes. It was pretty cool to see.
Jana Marie, the forensic investigation program at Platteville, it's really unique in Wisconsin and even in the country. What do students learn when they come through this program?
The program at UW-Platteville actually was the first in Wisconsin to have a bachelor's in forensic science, and it continues to be the largest program. We actually are at the very end of applying for what's called FEPAC, the Forensic Education Programs Accreditation Committee. That is through the American Academy of Forensic Sciences. There's only 4 FEPAC accredited. We would be one of 4 in the Midwest, the Upper Midwest, or the Great Lakes region. So that is very unique to Platteville. And we have a lot of hands-on learning here. So I'm currently sitting in, actually, the crime scene house, which is called the Fish House. And it was built in the 2010s, but it was specifically built for our program. So there's sensors in the walls, there's cameras that we can, there's, you know, mirrors that you can, that you don't have to be present when the students are doing scene work. So that's, the house is built specifically for us, and it's out by the farmland, by the swine center, and it's called Pioneer Farm. So not only do we have a house here that we do crime scenes, how you would document those scenes, how you would interpret those scenes. But we also have land that is used for taphonomic research, which is decomposition studies, things like that. So if you're going to go into death investigation, you need to know how decomposition works, what's normal, because you need to know what's normal so that you know what's not normal. So, but a law enforcement as well, or anyone being going into work with CSI, anyone going out to a scene is going to need an understanding of how you will come across a death scene, and you need to know what is appropriate for that scene. So we have land where we are right next to the swine center. So they provide us with pigs as well. So we have those kinds of studies. And that is, we are the only one in Wisconsin to have taphonomic land to do studies like that.
We are talking with UW-Platteville Professor Jana Marie Truesdell and Danielle Beyer, a student at UW-Platteville, president of the Forensic Investigation Club there. And we're looking at shoe prints and crime solving with Jana Marie, who is a forensic anthropologist. Danielle, you know, we drummed up this statistic, more than 22 billion pairs of shoes that are produced worldwide each year. That is a ton of shoes. So yeah. How do forensic experts and rising forensic experts like yourself decide what kind of shoe prints are most important to document for the state database?
So when we were at the lab, she kind of told us to think about what pair of shoes you would wear while committing a crime, which sounds terrible, but it kind of helped put into perspective, like, you're probably not going to show up in heels. So those probably aren't very good to, you know, take your time to do the impression of, but more like everyday shoes and that kind of stuff. And with so many pairs being produced each year, the outsoles of each make and model are all the same. So you can get rid of like any colors, like none of that stuff matters. So that does limit it down a lot, like when you are looking for different shoes.
Jana Marie, are there different techniques for gathering these prints? You know, you've talked about these powder-based impressions or standing on ink, but there's also, I understand, this new 3D scanner approach.
I love 3D scanning. I will use 3D scanning for anything you will let me. And Daniel's mentioned it a few times. The workshop that we did, or the clinic, was we had the ink impressions on the one side for the database, just to get the quota for that. But then we also had the dental stone, and we had some silicone and the different methods, the sort of older techniques. And then we had a 3D station. So there are a lot of great, the technology with the 3D scanners has come along, and it's coming along so rapidly that we now have, you know, small, very portable handheld scanners. Some of them the size of, you know, an iron. They're very small. They're very easy to use. And you can get every single nook and cranny of whatever it is you're scanning, just depending on how long you have to do it. It's completely non-invasive. You are not destroying or interrupting any patterns. You're not leaving any powders. You're not disturbing the shoe in any way. You're just scanning it with light. So it's completely non-destructive. It then feeds into a software, and it's extremely, extremely detailed, like down to the millimeter. And you can then 3D print it if you'd like. So you can just keep the data and use it as a representation. You can show that in court. You can just look at it on the screen, and it's movable, so you can move it around in space and see the different shadows. And you can also, one of the benefits there also is that you can change views. So if you wanted to see it in black and white, if you wanted to see it in, you just wanted to see the mesh, you just wanted to see different, you can look at it in different ways, which obviously you can't do just with a physical one. So you could either keep it on screen, or you could choose to 3D print it, and then it would be just like having the shoe itself.
Wow, so versatile. As I hear this, Danielle, it sounds like there is so much emerging technology. There are so many ways to help in this process. And, you know, being president of the Forensic Investigation Club at Platteville, I imagine you're in the thick of it. What is the role of the club, and what does the club do?
Yeah, so our club, we focus on kind of broadening the awareness of forensic science, like around our campus. Our club is open to anyone and everyone, so you don't have to be a forensic major. And then we kind of go into different like subsections of forensics per se. So sometimes we focus on maybe like the more law enforcement side and kind of in relation to that. Or we'll do more lab-based activities like fingerprinting, evidence packaging, all that kind of stuff, just to get everyone kind of immersed in the different fields to kind of see what they want to do later on.
What might you want to do?
I am not completely sure. I am interested in so many things. I'm kind of between pathology and toxicology at the moment.
And what does the future hold for career prospects? Are you optimistic, Daniel?
I think I am very optimistic about that, just because of all the new technologies coming out and everything related to that. It's opening up a lot of new windows for people to kind of get into those fields and gain that experience and opportunities.
Well, Jana Marie and Danielle, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate it.
That was Jana Marie Truesdell, Assistant Professor of Criminal Justice and Forensic Investigation at UW-Platteville, and sophomore Danielle Beyer, President of the Forensic Investigation Club for Students on Campus. We've been talking about shoe prints and crime solving and a new partnership between UW-Platteville and the Wisconsin State Crime Lab for students to provide ink impressions and 3D scanned reference prints for the state database.
Coming up, when a community faces drinking water contamination or an aging well, it can cost millions of dollars to fix the problem. Hear from village administrators getting relief through a loan program.
Our village doesn't take in very much, and it would take us 40 years to come up with $3 million to put into a new well.
How municipalities tackle big infrastructure bills, that's next.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. When a community faces drinking water contamination or has an aging well system, it can cost millions of dollars to fix that problem.
For the hundreds of villages here in Wisconsin, those projects can make up a huge part of their annual budget and force them to take on significant debt to provide clean drinking water to residents.
Recently, the Evers administration announced over $280 million in financial assistance for Wisconsin municipalities through the state's Safe Drinking Water Loan Program.
We're checking in now on a pair of village projects that received funding through the program. Matt Gantenbein is village president of Dickeyville, and Sandy Kulik is village administrator for Hales Corners. Matt and Sandy, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
Matt, starting with you, I understand that Dickeyville, so this village in the southwest corner of the state, is planning to construct a new well. What is driving that need for your community?
Well, our well that we currently have right now was installed in 1950, and it just isn't the what we need right now for our residents of Dickeyville. We needed something that's going to be able to supply a lot more water for the demand that we need.
Dickeyville only has about 900 residents. How hard is it to get an infrastructure project off the ground?
Well, it takes years of planning. We kind of been looking at this for about the last 3 years, I believe. And now with all the industrial coming to town, you know, it kind of puts a burden on what we do have and need to upgrade our wells that we do have right now. Like our well, we have two wells currently in town, and one went down last year for our 10-year checkup on that well, and it was down, and we blew pumps in our good well that was put in 1967. So we couldn't just rely on our number one well. We needed to well two as well, but when well two went down, our well one was working extremely hard.
Mm. And so for heavy industry to come to town, for you to get more businesses, more jobs, you need these wells to be in very good working order.
100% correct. I mean, if you don't have the supply that they need, you know, they're going to look elsewhere to go. And we're sitting in a really good spot right now with businesses coming over, coming down, and relocating their businesses. And if you don't have the needs that they do need, it's not going to be worth their time or their efforts to put their money into the village.
And Sandra, turning to Hales Corners in Milwaukee County, you're dealing with PFAS contamination in the water. How big of an issue is this for your residents?
So ours is kind of a backward system. The village of Hales Corners doesn't own the water utility. Anybody that is connected to municipal water is through a agreement from 1974 with Milwaukee Water Works. So there's pockets of the village that have private well systems, like individual homes. And then we had three. We now only have one more left after this project that had a municipal well system. So ours is it's called the Hales Happiness Water Trust. It was established in 1952 or something like that. They had three wells. Well one went down. Well two was contaminated with PFAS, and it backflowed into well number one, contaminating that one. Oh. So they basically were operating about 188 homes approximately in we're a small municipality of about, 8,000 people were affected. So a good chunk of the city, very, very population dense area, was regulated by the DNR because they serve more than 50 customers. So the well failed in June of 2023. It failed a DNR water test. And the members of the trust came to us asking for help. So it's like, okay, your options are to convert to Milwaukee Water. It's all we have.
And Milwaukee Water Works has been testing drinking water for PFAS since 2008. What do you think of that monitoring window? I mean, is that a long time to be attentive to forever chemicals in drinking water?
Probably, except that, again, this system wasn't owned by Milwaukee Water Works. It's only regulated by the DNR.
Ah.
Once we complete it, it's a private well system owned by these 188 homes, or was. Mm. So our project is different than any other one. There's, I believe, across the entire state, there's only 9 of these left, these private water systems that are regulated utilities that are owned privately, not by the municipality. So we have these individual little houses that I wish there was some platform for them to get their individual wells tested, but their only option would be the same. They'd have to connect to Milwaukee Water, and without having a significant number of parcels, that's going to be very expensive.
Matt, has your community in Dickeyville been dealing with contaminants in water, and what are the source points?
No, we haven't had any of that where there's contaminants or whatnot, mm-hmm. but we have been doing our regular DNR, phosphorus, and all that, up to date, So as far as contaminants go, no, we're not in any state of that.
I think about how for a village, and you need, say, Matt, a new well, you have to have the expertise to write the RFPs and to analyze the bids that come in and do that very closely, and you have to be able to write the grants. And I wonder for both of you, are these administrative areas a challenge to do as a village? Matt, you first.
Well, I'll tell you, us having a Delta 3 engineering group, they help us an extremely, extremely a ton with on what we can apply for, And between all that of what our needs are, we put our needs ahead of everything and then focus on, all right, this needs to be done ASAP, or we wait until further down the road. So we put one of those binders all together to make sure that we're doing the right thing at the right time. But this well is needed. We can't go, what if well two breaks down and well one won't work? We won't be able to pass the water out to everybody that off of well one, you know, like we absolutely needed two wells, and it's time that we move forward with our third well.
Sandy, how about for you in Hales Corners? have you had to be an expert in so many different areas?
So I've been in municipal government for 29 years and gathered people along the way. So I relied on previous people that I worked with to help me through some of this. I contacted another municipality, actually in Waukesha County, that I used to work for. I drafted an RFP and asked him to look it over. He's a certified engineer managing a much larger community going, and he goes, holy cow, what is this? So this is my nightmare. And when someone who manages a population of 70,000 looks at my tiny little village and goes, wow, this is a monster project, I kind of tend to take his word for it. So I wrote it, had him review it, and then I asked Milwaukee Water to review, just to get the design team required, an RFP. And so I had Milwaukee Water make sure that I was meeting all of their criteria. When our project is complete, we turn it over to Milwaukee Water, and we don't even own the system anymore. So they had to be involved in it too. So they helped me review it. And then when it came to design selection, like picking the design firm, we ended up with R.A. Smith, who's done projects with us multiple times in the past and always been a good player. So we were fortunate that they came in as the low bid on the design. And they drafted all of the actual construction documents. So I just had to write the RFP for the design firm.
Mm. We are talking about the challenges in funding drinking water projects for small Wisconsin communities. And we have Dickeyville Village President Matt Gantenbein in the southwest corner of the state. And Hales Corners Village Administrator there, Sandy Kulik, in Milwaukee County. For Hales Corners, what does your funding look like?
So because of the nature of the project and the convoluted way we had to go, the ownership was a big issue. note, it would have hamstrung our debt levy capacity for a decade, for 10 years without that money. That's a tremendous impact, not just on the people in the Water Trust, but on the entire village as a whole.
For both of these projects, Matt and Sandy, I'm wondering if you can look at this on the other side once they're completed and what impact they'll make to quality of life in your villages. Matt, you first.
Well, like I said, it'll help our residents in town immensely, so that they don't have to continue to, you know, we don't have to continue to go to the residents and keep raising rates, you know. And then secondly, for these industries that come in, you know, with knowing that we have capable water that can get to them, you know, they're gonna choose us to come here. And we're sitting in a really good spot right now, but we're probably 20 years away before we notice an impact to where the village working on a $400,000 budget might be working with a $3 million budget. You know, it's all right there.
Mm. How about for you, Sandy, in Hales Corners, very close to Milwaukee? What might this project being completed do for your community?
For those homes, prior to when the Hales Happiness Trust was doing its thing, a 70-year-old water system was consistently failing. Water mains tore up the streets. They didn't have water. The water smelled. It was brown. So every home in there, and I don't want to say regardless of the price tag, but even with half of the full cost, their property values are going to skyrocket because they have clean, safe, reliable drinking water. And it's a very dense corner. Like, all of those properties are the smallest population or the smallest lot size in the village. They're all quarter acre lots. So it's a very dense area to have all be drawing off of one aquifer that was contaminated. Mm-hmm. So it'll improve not just their quality of life, it improves their asset value. They couldn't, from my understanding of this water contamination issue, you couldn't even grow garden vegetables because it would be in the vegetables.
Mm.
There were issues with washing your dog. So if you can't wash your dog with it, what is it doing to you when you're bathing in it?
What is your advice to other villages, other small Wisconsin communities that have either contamination or 70-year-old infrastructure water systems that need replacing?
This is the only option you've got. If you've got debt capacity, you're going to have to borrow for it. There's no way around it. The funds from the state are limited and getting a little harder to apply for. I think this cycle, and I don't want to speak for Dickeyville, but it was normally a pretty competitive grant cycle. So he touched on the planning of it, 3 years in the planning. Plan for these things, have a 10-year capital plan, decide where you need to go and what must be done, and prioritize those things. And it sounds like that's what they did. And that's what, frankly, we've been doing here for years. We've got a 5 and a 10-year capital plan. This was never on our radar because we don't own water.
Mm.
So when it comes to everything else, if you own, most municipalities own their water system and they're a regulated utility, and hopefully they're paying attention to those things.
Matt, in closing here, do you have any advice for other villages?
Yeah, like I said, you know, I'll touch back on it. You know, plan. You can't just go for the year. You know, we have 2-year terms here, you know, and that's the other thing is you have the turnover rate. You need to keep looking like 10 years down the road, you know, otherwise it's going to bite you, you know, like, and that goes for like streets and all that, you know. And I know that we're not on streets, but with that water and taking advantage of the grant monies that are out there, you know, you need to put your town out there, village out there to be able to plan and put it noticeable for the grants that are available.
Well, Sandy and Matt, thank you so much for sharing your projects and for joining us.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thank you.
That is Matt Gantenbein, village president of Dickeyville in the southwest corner of the state, and Sandy Kulik, village administrator for Hales Corners in Milwaukee County. They spoke about their water projects that are receiving funding from the state's Safe Drinking Water Loan Program. Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, sauna culture is booming. Visit a backyard Finnish sauna experience in the Driftless region.
I think we're kind of conditioned in our lifestyle to not sweat, to not want to sweat, but it's a fundamental human function to sweat.
The revival of a centuries-old practice, that's next from WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Centuries-old practices like saunas, cold plunges, and bathhouses are having a renaissance in the Midwest. Backyard sauna builders are trying to keep up with demand, and the culture around it, it's all booming.
This pleases Michael Nordskog. Nordskog wrote the book The Opposite of Cold, about the history, culture, and practice of Finnish sauna in the North Woods.
Sauna's a way of life for Nordskog. More than a decade ago, he built one on his 1800s farmstead in Lafarge, nestled in a valley in the Driftless region. Sits alongside a spring-fed stream just a stone's throw from his farmhouse kitchen table.
It is here that producer Rochelle Wilson and I were introduced to the Finnish sauna experience with Mike and his wife Jeannie. Mike starts by explaining how to pronounce the word.
Well, the way to go is sauna, as in the Finnish pronunciation. It's really the one Finnish word that is generally well-known in English, and so I think we should give tribute to them. But if you say sauna, the room is still going to be a wonderful place to be, and you're going to have a great experience.
You're not going to run me out of here.
But you might, right, you might offend the purists.
You know, there are lots of bathhouse cultures around the world. What is unique about Finnish sauna culture?
You know, all of them have similarities, of course, heat, and, you know, you're doing something with humidity in that room. I would say in terms of folk architecture, you need stones, you need heat, you need water, and you're throwing a lot of water onto the rocks eventually. Some water, a lot of water, depending on your discretion, but you have to have those elements. And so you're kind of alternating in Finnish sauna between really strong dry heat and then throwing water on the rocks, which doesn't raise the temperature. It feels like it does. It just extremely raises the humidity.
What brought you to saunas? Because from what I understand, you've had them in all the places you've lived almost.
Well, yeah, I grew up in northern Minnesota in a town with a lot of Finnish immigrants, with a lot of Scandinavian immigrants in general. And my grandparents had a cabin on the lake. It's the same sauna that's on the cover of my book. And it's one that I got to experience my whole life. And at some point in the 1990s, the building was kind of tired. So my brothers and my dad and I, we got together and rehab that building and kind of rededicated it. And in studying about that and what we should do, the ethnography part of it really, you know, caught fire for me. And I dug a little bit deeper. And I haven't had one in a home before, actually, until we moved to this farm where we are now 15 years ago. And I don't know, it was probably about 4 or 5 years in, we finally had the sauna operational here.
What was that like for you to have it up and running and to use it as part of your lifestyle, your routine?
It's great because the cabin sauna is more like a vacation thing, and you're up there, you know, even at greatest frequency, maybe once every month or once every 6 weeks. Having it here, we do it regularly, every week, and sometimes twice a week. And by doing that, you get to kind of get a feel for the sort of the long-term health benefits of it, mental health benefits and physical health benefits, both for me. I just have a couple of chronic conditions from, like, I've had Lyme disease on a couple occasions, and, you know, the joint inflammation and those sort of things. It's good for that. Seasonal affected disorder, you know, you go and do sauna and cold plunge, and what I like to say is it just destroys stress. That process does.
Yeah.
You come out of it with your ego has kind of gone through the ringer, and you're just a much more objective and, you know, rebooted person.
So, Jeannie, what was it like for you to be introduced to sauna with, you know, by your spouse and really envelop this sauna culture?
Envelop is a great word, isn't it? So my experience, I tell Mike this often, I think the only time I'd ever had a sauna before was in a Best Western hotel with a swimming pool where I was going for swimming lessons. And then off of the locker room, there was this tiny little room, and you'd, you know, giggle and go in there with your friend, and it was stiflingly hot and you couldn't breathe. And I didn't understand why anybody would do that. The air was dry, which is the wrong thing. And it was really very unpleasant. And that was my experience until I about 30. I lucked into this wonderful guy with a cabin up in northern Minnesota. And he introduced me to traditional sauna. And it was a completely different experience. And it was sort of a meditation. It was a ritual in a way.
Mm-hmm.
It took a lot of doing. You had to split the wood, start the fire, stoke it a few times, put some water up on the rocks to get warm. And then you just, you know, you slowed down and you went in there. And it's, we like to refer to it as slow hygiene, because the reality is you can get clean in there. You can take a bath. And we used it as a place to bathe our whole family when we were up at the family cabin, because the cabin had no running water, has no running water. And so we would warm up some water. We'd have a bath, wash hair, scrub up. And then after all that, then generally the kids would go out, and then we could settle into the more, you know, the steaming, pushing the heat a little bit and relaxing and letting the mind kind of unwind with the shoulder tension and all the other things that it's good for.
Do you think it's changed your outlook at all? Has it changed anything within you?
Oh my gosh.
I don't, you know.
Yeah, I think it's part and parcel of a trend in my life towards slowing down, really savoring the moment, finding the beauty and the ritual, there's that word again, in really basic human needs. You know, we need to eat, we need shelter, we need to bathe now and again. And anybody who enjoys making a pot of soup from scratch, or, you know, baking something from really basic ingredients, will understand the joy of a sauna this way. You split the kindling, you build the fire, you tend it, you stoke it a few times. And then you go in, and, you know, after you've gone to that much trouble to build a fire and warm up the water and warm up the room, you don't want to rush that, the rest of it. So then you linger. And when we sauna, we're over there for at least an hour once we're in the room, and sometimes longer. I mean, it just, you stay as long as you need to. And sometimes that's longer, and sometimes, you know, it varies. And usually after a few rounds of steam and the cold plunge, if you are so inclined, you're just, you know, you're broken free from constraints. And it took me a long time to do the cold plunge, and I did it on my own time. I have an evangelist here who who started cold plunging regularly and really, really preached it hard. And I said, I will do it when I want to do it. And I finally did it, and now I do it on my own. I don't need any coaxing.
We're talking about the history and tradition of Finnish sauna culture in Wisconsin with Michael and Jeannie Nordskog. Michael's book is called The Opposite of Cold, The Northwoods Finnish Sauna Tradition. And I'm sitting with Mike and Jeannie at their kitchen table in Lafarge in their farmhouse, and about ready to head out for my first proper Finnish sauna. Can you talk about the architectural beauty of these saunas, of these little houses? And we can do this more as we go and take a tour, but just to talk about how they're made, how they're constructed, and the different materials that can be used?
Yeah, one thing to start with, I think, is, you know, saunas are very common in the upper Midwest, especially in the northern tier of Wisconsin, you know, in the upper peninsula of Michigan, northeastern Minnesota, northern Minnesota in general, corresponding with places where there was a fairly large amount of Finnish immigration. But that's, I like to talk about it as sort of being, you know, one of those cultural features that survived the melting pot, and the rest of the culture adopted it as well. And a lot of those people, of course, were Scandinavians who maybe had a little more familiarity with it. But it's a natural fit for us here, just like hockey is a natural fit for people in the Midwest. And so the buildings, you see them all over, especially in lakeside settings, and you kind of know, you know, what's this extra building here? Well, if you're a Midwesterner, you know that's probably a sauna, whether it's on an old farmstead. There's just a lot of innovation in it right now, striking buildings. It's a smaller building where, you know, one thing I like about building a sauna is you feel like you can afford to use finer materials. Mm-hmm. And the one material I think that's definitive of saunas in North America and the upper Midwest is the use of northern white cedar. The cedar boards for the paneling inside. Yeah. It's a really long lived wood, and it really has a telltale fragrance to it. And, it, you know, nowadays people use the related species from out west, but one and the same with both of those. It really, for a lot of people, that's sort of synonymous with sauna is the smell of cedar. Whereas in Finland, you go into saunas and they don't have that species over there, so they don't use it.
Are saunas here having a moment? Is this kind of a cultural awakening for saunas?
It's really been fascinating to watch it. I mean, about the time I wrote the book, there was certainly a lot happening more with public sauna, and you started to see these organizations that, you know, made public sauna available, often built on a trailer so that it can be moved to, say, a popular lakeshore for a popular event or for private events somewhere. That has just really blossomed. But with COVID also, and then I think the emphasis on personal health and self-care that came out of that, and maybe the need to have, you know, something self-sustaining in your own homestead, the popularity of at-home saunas has really gone through the roof too. And, you know, in that context, saunas can be built inside the house, but when I hear the word sauna, I tend to think of a building that's on its own out there, and that which lends itself maybe more to having a wood-fired stove, and all those elements really play into the pleasure of the activity. You know, it's building a fire rather than throwing a switch. It takes longer to do. It takes longer for it to heat up, but then you have the roar of the fire, you have the flickering firelight, you have the smell of smoke, you know.
It's meditative.
Savory, and mm-hmm. Yeah.
After hearing Mike and Jeannie talk about the magic of a Finnish sauna experience, it's time to test it out. So we get into our swimsuits and head out to the backyard. Mike and Jeannie's sauna is a small structure lined with fragrant cedar panels. The hot room's wood-burning stove heats up the stones. The thermometer on the wall creeps up. I climb up to the top bench and into the hottest part of the room.
I felt the heat rise when I came up these steps, these two little steps. What temperature are we? I can't really tell. What temperature are we at here?
The temperature is about 188 degrees in here now. I keep blinking to make sure my contact lenses don't dry up. Mike says saunas go as low as 160 degrees and can top out above 230 degrees.
Now I'm starting to sweat here. It's starting to flow, which is exactly where you want to get before you throw any water on the rocks.
At this point, it's a dry heat, but there's water that's starting to bubble next to the wood stove for the next stage in this sauna experience.
It sounds like tea water.
Yep.
And this is a stove that's built custom for sauna use, so it's got this capacity to, you know, cradle the rocks around it.
I'm starting to sweat. Woo! Yep.
After about 15 minutes, I need to take my first break and step outside. Alternating between the heat and the cold is part of the sauna ritual. Oh,
wow. So I would suggest just stepping out quickly.
Okay, I'm going to step out.
Me too.
I can still see the steam coming out.
And even without the clogs, step on the ground. Step
oh, on. Come on.
Come on.
After our bodies drink in the frigid 12-degree air outside the sauna door, we head back in for another round, and Mike starts up the main event, pouring water on the rocks.
Okay, we're going to do two scoops.
Okay.
Okay, here we go. Wow, it's like a roller coaster of steam coming at me. I'm feeling it. Yep. Holy moly.
And it stings a little if your
it's
hands
stinging.
Are...
It's stinging. Yeah.
Are you catching these?
During our next break, producer Rochelle and I look at the cold plunge tub with trepidation and decide to try just a little splash of ice water on our face and hands.
All right, Rochelle, this is going to be short and sweet.
All right.
Woo! Okay. That's cold. Uh-huh.
Yep, even though I'm not ready to take the plunge yet and climb all the way into this tub of icy water, Mike shows us how it's done.
Woo!
We leave you at the icy tub outside the Nordskog sauna on their farm in Lafarge, where Michael and Jeannie so graciously let us in on their weekly sauna ritual. Michael Nordskog's book is called The Opposite of Cold. This piece was produced by Rochelle Wilson with technical direction from Sarah Hopeful. It's a big year coming in politics in Wisconsin, with a state Supreme Court election in the spring, and then a wide open race for governor in the fall, along with the state legislature.
We'll provide coverage and analysis through the year, maybe with a little help from you.
What issue do you want to hear about as we cover these big elections? What questions do you want candidates to answer? What are some of the things that will sway your vote? What issue is especially important in your community?
Tell us about it, and your input can help us shape our coverage in the year to come.
Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org or call or text. The number is 888-642-0232. Once again, that's 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today.
While you're there, you can explore our archives of great conversations and share your favorite Wisconsin Today interviews, too. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.